This podcast was recorded on the date indicated with the link. The views and opinions expressed herein are as of the date recorded and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities. Such views and opinions may differ from those of DoubleLine Capital or its affiliates and are subject to change without notice. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide updates or changes. Welcome to Monday Morning Minutes, hosted by DoubleLine's fixed income asset allocation strategists and portfolio managers, Samuel Lau and Jeffrey Mayberry. Please direct any comments and suggestions to minutes@doubleline.com or see us on Twitter at @DLineMinutes.
Welcome to this week's episode of DoubleLine Monday Morning Minutes. I'm Jeff Mayberry here with Sam Lau.
Hey, hey.
Well, we're recording just after the close, Friday, March 25th. It was a great sports night last night. It was flipping between channels. I was watching the U.S. play Mexico on the pitch, a 0-0 draw, even though, as Jeffrey Gunlock used to say, soccer score just in 0-0. It was still an exciting game. And we did get half of the NCAA Sweet 16 games. By Monday morning, we'll have the Final Four will be set in the NCAA men's basketball, and hopefully the U.S. men's soccer team will have qualified for their World Cup in December.
You know, I was actually right this time around, and all the times I ask you if it's the World Cup, it actually was in preparation, at least, for the World Cup. So I'm getting closer.
Yeah.
One of these days this year, I'll be right.
During winter, it's a World Cup's in winter this time. This winter, you'll be correct every time we're watching.
So yeah, almost nine more months.
All right. Well, let's get into where are we for the week.
Okay, so this is where we are. Looking across the board here, it looks like a little bit of risk on for the week. The S&P 500 up 1.8%. We are just under a week away from quarter end, it looks like. So giving you the little preview to see if how we're looking at on a quarter to date basis, the S&P 500 is still down over 4%. So, but it has made up some ground over the past few weeks here. It sure doesn't feel like it, but it has been, it looks like it's been trending up ever so slightly. If you pull out the microscope, looking across the board here, energy is a familiar face as the leader here, up almost 7.5% for the week to date. Quarter to date, up over 40%. And then on the flip side, we've got healthcare with the lone sector out of 11, putting up a negative print for this week ending March 25th. That's down 20 basis points for the week. And then on the quarter to date basis, as well as the year to date basis, the worst performing sector is communication services. Moving across to fixed income land, a lot of big moves this week, Jeff. The two-year treasury yield is up 35 basis points. I had to blink a couple of times to make sure I'm reading that right. But it's closing the week here at a 2.3% yield on the round. And then the 10-year is up 33 basis points, closing the week off just under 2.5%. And then the bond is up 17 bips. Just closing under 2.6% yield there. So we've seen a little bit of a curve flattening there pretty much across the board. But looking at it right here, the twos, tens, looks like it just flattened by a basis point if you give me the round on that one.
I'll give you the round.
Yeah, give me the round and we'll make it make an honest man out of me here. So looking at that, the twos, tens is just at about 20 basis points on the spread between the 10-year yield and the two-year treasury yield as well. What this means for the Bloomberg Barclays U.S. aggregate is a lot of red. The ag, it looks like it's down about 1.9% for the week, down just under almost to down 7% on the year-to-date basis. Looking across here, the worst performer is going to be the IG corporate credit space, down over 2% for the week and down almost 10%. That's right, 10% on this, not even the first quarter of the year here. So it's definitely rough going there as IG corporate credit, as you've listen, as I've heard us say, you know, time and time again, comes the way it's positioned now, it comes with both the double whammy hit of duration and the credit hit right now, at least thus far. So looking over at U.S. Treasuries then, and as well as agency mortgage-backed securities, those were both down almost 2% for the week to date. Looking at more of the credit sector here, high yield corporate credit was down about 1.5%, so fared better than the components of the Barclays aggregate by a little bit. And then bank loans, which do have that floating rate component, but it wasn't enough to kind of offset that credit impact this week. That's down just under 20 basis points for the week as well. And then EM is down as well, down 1.7% week to date. So right across the board when we're looking at fixed income land here in the common indices that we look at.
At least you, in your high yield, your riskier side, you're getting a little bit more yield. I just pulled up the IG corporate index and it yields, you know, call it 370. So you gotta have a lot of years of no movement in interest rates to make up that down 10%.
Yeah, that's we'll keep watching. I'm not sure if that's going to happen.
I'm going to say that it's not going to be flat. Our yields are not going to remain unchanged for the next 3 years.
That's right. So moving over to the fixed, moving over to commodities, the commodity market, strong week. It looks like we have the Bloomberg Commodity Index up 5.25%. For the year to date, it's up over 30%. Right now, looking at WTI, it's a bit of a pain because this translates into our pockets as we're talking about gassing up our cars. But where it all starts from is WTI crude oil, and that's up it's up almost 8% on a week-to-date basis. In terms of the dollar price on a barrel of WTI, it's just under $113 a barrel, up from $105 the week prior. So definitely some strong gains in that side of the commodity market. Speaking of which, gold also is up almost 1.5% on the week to close March 25th off at $19.55 a troy ounce. And then looking at over to digital gold, we see Bitcoin here up over 6% for the month to date. And on the year to date basis, it's down over 4%. Not too bad for Bitcoin. It can make that up in a couple seconds here if it wanted to. Yeah. But it has had some strong moves this week, as we just heard, and now it's hovering at just under 44,500 a Bitcoin. Just taking a note here, we've been keeping tabs on the nickel market. You and I were just commenting prior to hitting the record button on this podcast that nickel at least had 2 weeks of, or sorry, 2 days of actual trading with clean closes. In that market where it did not push up against a limit on the upside or push down on the down limit this week. But it did have an interesting week here. It started out if listeners recall last week, it hit the limit down each time when it finally reopened last Wednesday, down 5%, then down 8%, then down 12% each time hitting that lower bound of the limit. It continued that trend on Monday of this week, hitting that lower limit of 15% on Monday, and then Tuesday we had a clean close, followed by 2 days of up limits, go figure, with these wacky commodity markets, especially when they're manipulated by the exchange and the powers that control them there. But up 15% on both up limit days there, and then today it had another clean close, down 5%. So a lot of roller coaster going on in the nickel market, but they did close the week down 4%, still on the front month futures basis, it's still up a whopping 70% though on the week, but I figure that's going to be probably wound down a little bit as we go through the year.
Yeah. I mean, you get two out of five. So you're batting 40% on actually being able to trade, so maybe we'll get 3 days next week that we can actually trade.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to see it getting any worse in terms of where we've come from. So, we kind
it's
of
true. At least it's open now.
Yeah. We've kind of seen the worst, at least, in our minds, and we'll see how it progresses. I can only hope for improvement from here.
Yeah.
So with that, that's where we are for the week ending March 25th on the market front. Jeff, do you want to kick us off on how things looked from macro land?
Yeah, as we did talk about last week, it's a pretty quiet week. Yesterday, a Thursday, we got durable goods. The February preliminary numbers came out. It seems like you would expect those numbers to be a little bit more final here now that we're in March or close to the end of March, but we did get the February numbers. It was a big miss, fell 2.2% versus an expectation of only falling 0.6%. This was the first negative print since February of last year. So maybe the February, this time period tends to be maybe a little bit weaker. We also got the, that's always going to mess me up, but the S&P Global Manufacturing and Services PMI numbers came in big surprises to the upside. Manufacturing came in at 58.5, services at 58.9. Mark Kimbrough, our analyst, said, these numbers are still recovering from the January, and he called it a quote, speed bump.
I'll probably be there, Jeff. I'm going to remind our listeners that what Jeff was walking through right now is what he formally called market open. I couldn't resist. I applaud you for your tenacity there and perseverance in not saying it. I couldn't resist.
Okay. Yeah. Well, maybe after a few more months of this, we'll get used to this S&P Global name and no more market with an I.
Well, seeing our track record with the Bloomberg U.S. bond aggregate, I think it'll take us a while.
I still call it the Lehman Ag, or you almost call it the Bloomberg Barclays.
Yeah.
Ag,
the Lehman Ag just flows, right? It's like you just have to sit there and think and stumble through it. But yeah.
And then Wednesday and Friday, or Wednesday and today, we did get some home sales numbers. New home sales disappointed. Pending home sales actually fell 5.4% year over year versus a 2.2% expectation. This is a fourth straight month of disappointment from pending home sales. This is as mortgage rates are spiking. They're up to around 4.5% for a 30-year fixed rate mortgage. So pretty significant increase in mortgage rates over a very short period of time. So again, we'll keep an eye on the housing market and see how rising mortgage rates, while low from historical standards, are high from the, from the absolute lows that we have seen recently. And then we did get some Fed speak. Obviously, Jay Powell was the one that everyone wanted to focus on. He did say that the Fed will hike by more than 25 basis points each time if needed, that if the Fed needs to tighten above the neutral rate, it will do so. And that, it really seems like he's making the case for faster interest rate hikes. One of the things that he also mentioned is that this is in front of the National Association for Business Economics. He said there's good research by staff in the Federal Reserve that looks at the first 18 months of the yield curve. That's really what has 100% of the explanatory power of the yield curve. It makes sense because if it's inverted, that means the Fed's going to cut, which means the economy is weak. And so what we did is we looked at, and Jim Bianco put it in a post in his conference call, looked at the two-year treasury, less the three-month treasury, two very widely known, easily, Sam, as you found, we obviously know what the two-year treasury is trading at. We know what the three-month T-bill is trading at. We can do the difference there pretty easily. But we compared that to the, and we always mess this up, but Jim Bianco calls it the implied forward rate 6 quarters ahead on the three-month T-bill, less the three-month T-bill. And you and I were struggling with exactly how to call it, but really you're kind of saying, 6 quarters is definitely like economist speak, but, 18 month forward, what the market is implying, the 3 month T-bill rate will be 18 months forward, compare that to the 3 month T-bill. And really at the important times, the times when the curve is inverted, both the 2 year and this made up economist number invert at the same time. So, Powell can say, we really only look at the first 18 months of the yield curve, whatever, yada, yada, yada. Look at the 2 year, you look at the 3 month T-bill, the difference there when that inverts, this other, economist measure also inverts. And so, it's much easier to look at the two, as you would like to say, Sam, twos, threes, but it's twos, 3 months.
This one's almost the other way around, bro, too, because you got what I call the threes, tens, is the 3 month, three month, 10 year. This was the 2 year, 3 months. So
that's right.
There you have it. It's just like, there you go with the Fed creating these nuisances for us.
Of course. And we always like to look at, these are the things that we want to look at market rates. We don't want to look at things the Fed directly controls. We want to look at how the market's interpreting Fed actions. And so when the 2 year, 3 month inverts, again, it's showing the same thing. It means showing that the market thinks the Fed's going to cut. That's why the 2-year rate's going down. The 3-month is still the Fed is behind on terms of their cuts. They're not going to be cutting over the next 3 months. So that's really when that inverts. That's really what we look at. The economy is going to be weak.
That kind of follows in the footsteps of the things that we've always been talking about. And actually, Jim Bianco, that since you mentioned him, he says it a lot. Jim says the Fed is the, we always say that the Fed hikes until they break the economy. Jim, puts it a little bit more colorfully and says that the Fed is a serial killer of the economy. So it's one of those things where once the 2 year starts to drop, it's basically expecting that the Fed, probably on forward-looking guidance, that the Fed has to start cutting rates after their period of hiking to the point that they broke the economy. And now, we're starting to go all the way around and bring rates back, the Fed funds target rate, to which the 2-year follows a little bit more closely based on those expectations for those moves. Then when that starts to fall relative to 3-month T-bill, then that kind of makes sense, I suppose, but it is a little different way of looking at it. So thanks, I guess, Jay Powell for bringing it up that way, but maybe it's a little bit of hubris just talking about the influence that they have on that portion of the curve.
Well, they're always trying to confuse things and throughout different, different standards, as usual from the Fed.
That's right.
Also from the Fed speak, Neil Kashkari, who's usually the most dovish or certainly when you look at the dots, he's usually the one that has the lowest dot out there. He came out and basically posted a blog post that said he was wrong and that inflation's very high. Obviously, we all know that. And he's now shifted his thoughts for 7 rate hikes this year, that this was coming right before the last Fed meeting. So 6 more from here. And that he shifted his views dramatically in the last six months. And he thinks there's a danger to overdoing it on rate hikes. And the Fed's trying to engineer a soft landing. But, really, when he's out there saying 7 rate hikes this year or 725 basis, let's be clear, 725 basis point rate hikes this year, that's really the kind of lower bound for what the Fed's going to do. And in kind of light of that, and kind of light of Powell talking about, doing 50 basis point rate hikes if they need to, you now have, it wasn't that long ago when everyone was going crazy, when I think it was one of the Wall Street banks said that they're going to do this, the Fed's going to do this crazy thing and hike every single meet 25 basis points at every single meeting. Now we have banks tripping over themselves to forecast faster and more front-loaded rate hikes. And we saw one Wall Street bank say now they think the Fed's going to do 50 basis points in May, 50 basis points in June, 50 basis points in July, and then another 50 basis points in September. So those of you keeping score, that's 200 basis points here over the next 6 months, and then 25 in October and December. So that's another 250 basis points in Fed rate hikes through the rest of the year. And really, when you look at it, and it seems pretty outlandish out there. And I think that it'll be other banks will start to raise their forecasts. But when you look at the market's pricing in a 2% implied rate change before the end of the year. So they're only 50 basis points ahead of that. Maybe it's a little bit more front-loaded. And it's certainly more front-loaded than the market's pricing in right now. Market's pricing in kind of a 77% chance of a 50 basis point hike in May, but then you don't get another 50 basis points in June yet. You're going to start to see those numbers kind of being priced into the market and see how high the market will let, or how fast and how high the market will let the Fed get.
Yeah, I mean, it's just been developing so quickly. I mean, if we just think back to what our expectations were for total rate hikes for 2022, as recently as January, it's just pretty remarkable how quickly these expectations have changed. And it seems like the market is kind of absorbing it, right? I think that points to the fact that the Fed and Jay Powell have been pretty good at just managing the forward-looking expectations.
Yeah, I mean, you talked about the 10-year up 30 basis points, up to 2.5%. It started the year at 1.5. It's at 2.5 now. We're not even done with the first quarter. So the market really seems to think, at least thus far, the Fed is not going to cause a recession. I guess they're not pricing in a recession right now. So the Treasury market, at least, and certainly with stock market positive also, no recession on the horizon.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a good segue for the question of the week that we got from one of our long-term listeners, John, and he sent us an email earlier this week asking us to kind of break down our thoughts on, you know, the impending quantitative tightening. And he says, "Hi, Sam and Jeff. My question pertains to quantitative tightening and the 10-year treasury yield. Last time that QT happened, the long bond was hurt by rising rates." God, my reading is horrible. How do you guys think about this, as well as TIPS versus nominal bonds, as the market for real treasuries has been dominated by uneconomic buyers? I think he's talking about the Fed there, as you know, in terms of their support through quantitative easing, and there being uneconomic buyers because they're price agnostic. Rather, they're trying to achieve a quantity versus and agnostic to the price. But he follows up by saying that if demand for TIPS falls, wouldn't this push up the break-even rates? Thanks. So Jeff, I know you did some background work on this earlier this week. What are your thoughts around the questions and topics that John has for us?
Yeah, thanks, John. Thanks for the question. You confirmed that our email address is still working.
It's getting worried there for a while.
It wasn't some Twitter Twitter email saying you've logged in from a new device or something like that, which is what it tends to be. Let's just start with the QT. As you struggled with quantitative tightening, we're just going to call it QT going forward. And if you remember the last round of quantitative easing from after the financial crisis, that ended in October of 2014. December 2015, we had the liftoff of rates. We back then, contrary to what we just talked about and what the market's pricing in, the Fed raised rates by 25 basis points. So one hike in 2016, 3 25 basis point hikes in 2017, and then one a quarter in 2018. That brought the Fed funds rates to for the range of 2.25 to 2.5. So very different kind of Fed outlook there. Where it took them 4 years to kind of get to two and a quarter to two and a half. Whereas here we're talking about we're going to get there by the end of this year. So kind of a different, more aggressive Fed this time around. And I think we can kind of point to the fact that there is inflation this time versus last time there was really no inflation. But really, we talk about quantitative tightening, or as the Fed likes to call it, balance sheet normalization. That was announced in September of 2017. And that actually began in October of 2017. So from the time the Fed raised rates in liftoff in December 2015 to October 2017, it was 20 months from liftoff to reduction to balance sheet reduction. Here we're talking maybe a liftoff certainly was in March of this year, and now there's talk of balance sheet normalization occurring in May. So a much shorter time frame again this time. The QT last time, there was no active selling. It allowed maturities to run off, capped at a certain amount. They started at a cap of $6 billion in treasuries and $4 billion in agency mortgages per month and allowed to run off. Anything more than that in agency mortgages that came due to prepayments was actually reinvested into treasuries because they were trying to get out of holding agency mortgages. But that cap of $6 billion and $4 billion was raised every quarter until they got to $30 billion in treasuries running off and $20 billion in agency mortgages. So that, that gives you five quarters for them to get to that cap. They got to that cap very, over those five quarters, but really soon after that, in March of 2019, they reduced the cap on treasuries from $30 billion to only $15 billion. They announced the end of QT in March, they reduced the cap from 30 to 15. And then at that same time, they also said they would reduce that to zero and keep the balance sheet where it was in September, but they kind of panicked. And on July 31st of that year, so 4 months later, they ended quantitative tightening from that framework. And really, when you think about it, you look at what did the 10-year do? You actually, kind of started earlier than that because you had the taper tantrum, which was kind of built into the, you can't really look at the QE and the QT movements without pricing in the taper tantrum. So taper tantrum 10-year rates went from 150 to 2.5, soon on their way to 3%. At the end of QE there in October of 2014, rates were around 3%. And they continued to fall to about 2%, a little bit below, bouncing around that 2% to 2.5% level through the end of QE. Liftoff, the 10-year was at 1.5%. And as the balance sheet normalized, that rates actually went from 2 to almost 3% again. And on the peak, you know, looking at the month-to-month numbers, the peak was on October 31st of 2018. The 10-year peaked at 3.14. And as the as we kind of got to the end of that balance sheet normalization, we did get the infamous Powell pivot, and that's what really caused the interest rates to rally a lot. And you got that reduced runoff normalization, and you got to back down to that 1.5 to 2% type 10-year level. And really, so really, when you think about it, you would think that as the Fed is selling or not buying as much in treasuries or agency mortgages as they were in the past, you would expect that that would lead to interest rates rising. And certainly for the first half of the quantitative tightening, it did lead to yields rising a little bit, not as much as you would think, though, because it really the market really tends to front run these things, right? So the market thinks, okay, taper's coming. We're going to raise rates because taper is going to be followed by some balance sheet normalization or selling. And then when it became the end of QE, and it was much more that the Fed was going to take their time and a long time before they would actually start normalization, rates rallied. When the Fed starts lifting off interest rates, and they start talking more about balance sheet normalization again, rates rose a lot on the fact that they're thinking that the market is thinking the Fed's going to start selling. And you get to that point, that high in rates, and then it's like, oh, the market is, or you know, the Fed's responding to these bumps in the market, and they reduce the amount of sell or maturities they're going to allow, and really, so then the rates rallied from there. So really, the market is going ahead, kind of moving a little bit ahead of the Fed, and kind of moving in ways that you would think are maybe are different, or moving in the opposite direction of what you would think, just kind of being blindly looking at the supply demand dynamic of solely of the Fed. And so really, when you think about it, we've had a pretty good move here so far this year. You know, we're at 2.5%. We started the year at 1.5. So a lot of that kind of pricing in of balance sheet unwind, liftoff is already being priced into the market. So, you know, while I would expect that the rates would continue to rise here on, you know, kind of on a go forward basis, it's really going to depend on how fast does the Fed go through their balance sheet unwind. And Powell did say at the press conference, the framework is going to look very familiar to people who are familiar with the last time we did this, but it'll be faster than the last time. And so if you remember, just to kind of annualize the numbers, last time the balance sheet unwind peaked at $600 billion for the year, $30 billion in treasuries, $20 billion in agency mortgages per month. This morning, we did see I saw a Wall Street estimate that said they expect the Fed to reduce their balance sheet at $1 trillion per year. So you know, that's certainly faster than $600 billion, but a trillion is a nice round number. And I guess the balance sheet is $9 trillion or so. So they have a long ways to go. You can't really do it in these small, you know, half, you know, we'll call it quote unquote small, half a trillion reductions, because that would take, you know, 18 years to get down to zero. Not that they want to get to zero, but whatever they want to have as their more normal number, it would take a lot of years to get there. So they really need to have that, because the balance sheet went up by so much, they need to have the size of the unwind be so much larger on the other side.
Yeah, it's one of these things where actually something that you mentioned early on, you said something about inflation being a headwind for QT and how it could be a different environment this time from the other one sample that we have when the Fed was embarking upon quantitative tightening. And when you mentioned it, just reminded me of a segment that I watched the other day. I think it was on Bloomberg TV or something like that, because I don't have cable to watch the other things. But Bloomberg TV, as I was watching, I caught Larry Summers on there. He was, for those who aren't familiar, he's the, amongst other things, he was a former U.S. Treasury Secretary. And the interviewer was asking him about a statement that someone from the Fed recently made. It may have been Powell at that conference that he was at earlier this week, where we joke about, you know, the Fed. How many times has the Fed been able to engineer a soft landing once they embark on their rate hike cycles? And we like to say it rhymes with zero, or we can take the other side of that and say, you know, with the Bianco serial killer comment. But either way, it's, you know, we tend to think that they haven't been able to orchestrate a soft landing. But apparently Powell said that they had been able to do it two times, once they embarked on their rate hike cycle. And this was back in 1984 and 1994. So when you mentioned that, you know, I started thinking back to the segment, and Larry said, well, every other time there, of the last seven recessions, each of those seven recessions were preceded by the Fed hiking rates. And the two times, the 1984 and the 1994, where they didn't cause, or there wasn't a recession immediately following that period of rate hikes. The time that, what made that different was, it was in a period where there wasn't inflation fears. So that kind of made me think about what you're talking about, the QT. Here, truly, this time does look like it is one of those periods where, with rate hikes and, you know, inflation kind of is a scare, then this could lead to a more aggressive tightening cycle, either through hikes and or QT. But also with this, you know, we're seeing a period where we're in a period where we have significantly negative real rates already, whereas in 1984 and 1994, the Fed fund target rate was well above the rate of inflation in those times. So it'll be interesting really to see how the Fed manages to pull this off and, you know, get to the soft landing that they kind of are hinting that, you know, the economy can withstand, given where we have some of the strong economic fundamentals still, including the strong labor market that Powell has been talking about so much.
So you're saying this time is different?
I'm saying this time doesn't look like it's going to be different, because we have inflation above the Fed funds target rate. Even with the hike cycle that we're getting under, it still seems like we have quite a ways to get there. But the two times, again, that they were able to, the two times where it was different and they weren't, and they didn't crush the economy with the rate hikes, inflation was well below the starting place from where they began hiking the rates.
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting, Sam, when you're talking that, you know, you're talking about the Fed thinks they're going to engineer a soft landing, and certainly, you know, you could, one, chalked it up to some hubris of them thinking that they can engineer the soft landing, but also that the fact that I hope they would, because I, you know, I wouldn't want them to think that they're just going to raise rates until they break something. Yeah. That they, you know, that's not, you know, if that was the case, if they're expecting the worst or thinking that they're going to do the worst, then maybe they need a different course of action.
Although based on their track record, maybe they should just come to terms with it.
And those of you, if you remember 1994, and certainly I wasn't in the market back then, and Sam, I know you weren't either, but that was a very tumultuous year for the bond market. So I think it ended up okay at the end of the year, but it was a pretty wild ride. So if that's what we're, if that's one of our good cases for the Fed not tanking the economy and getting a wild ride in the bond market, then we should. I'd like to say we should strap in.
Yeah, I think you'll hear those two words or terms from us a lot in coming episodes. Hubris when we're talking about the Fed, and strap in when it comes to markets.
Did you want to talk about the tips market real quick, and any other podcast or, you know, other episodes that we kind of touch on some of this?
Yeah. So the other part of John's question was, you know, how do we think about tips as, you know, versus nominal bonds? If demand for tips falls, when this push up break-even rates? I think we've mentioned this in the past, but one of the things I think that John hit spot on is that the Fed has been an uneconomic buyer of the tips market. And I think that makes has a little bit bigger footprint than the nominal, despite them being fairly similar terms in terms of percentage owned. It's just that the tips market is such a small market relative to the nominals market. I think it's only about $1.7 trillion in the tips market, and it actually has grown fairly materially since the global financial crisis, but it's still only $1.7 trillion, of which the Fed owns somewhere around 22 to 25% of that market as of month end February. So if we think that the Fed is getting ready to pull back from that market there, if we think about how much they could pull back, we're looking at it pre-pandemic through, so let's just say starting from the post-GFC era, going through the end of 2019, the Fed had owned roughly 9% of that market. And it was pretty consistent. I mean, it'd go between 8% of the market up to 10%, but nowhere near these 20-25% of the marketable TIPS market that we're seeing today. So if they do start to pull back, you would think that that would be a negative for that overall market. So with that, it's, you know, I actually had the pleasure of talking to John a little bit last week on a different matter. And, you know, we just started, you know, going back and forth on some of the questions that he has. And I think this has a lot to do with perhaps the idea of inflation and how to be best positioned through it. And I think if you go within, if you do have that fear of inflation, you know, especially with some of the footprint that the Fed has in the TIPS market, I think the best way really to get protection against inflation is some of the things that we've been talking about as well, is just through real assets. And for most investors, it does seem to be commodities that really fits that bill. You know, you can easily get into a basket of a diversified commodities relative to something, let's say, I'm buying physical real estate, which can be a little bit more difficult, or perhaps even, you know, the REIT market, depending on how long you plan on holding those REITs. If it's shorter term, if you're just worried about inflation in the short term, they tend to have a little bit more correlation to the equity market within there. So I do think that commodities, if people are worried about the inflation out there, then that perhaps is the best way to get some protection from there. He does follow up the question with if demand for TIPS falls, with that, I guess rates would move, the rates on TIPS would, the yields on TIPS would move up. He follows it up by asking, wouldn't this push up the break-even rates? And I'm not sure if we covered break-evens in the past, but break-even rates are essentially the differential between nominal yields and the equivalent tenor yield for TIPS on there. And then really, they call it the break-even rate because that's the premium that is priced into the nominal treasury market in excess of the so-called real yield from TIPS to compensate investors for expected inflation. That's why we call the break-even rates the market-based expectation for inflation there. And it's a break-even even in the sense that if inflation actually exceeds that break-even rate, then the idea is that you would be compensated for that by holding TIPS. But with this, an economic buyer in there manipulating the market with their purchases on the early end when we're going through quantitative easing to where they're perhaps, you know, thinking about exiting or at least reducing their footprint through quantitative tightening, I think you're going to see distortion there. So I see break-evens as a signal for market-based inflation expectations as being broken. So it doesn't necessarily, you know, to follow up on the question, it doesn't necessarily push up break-even rates just if real yields move up, because it really depends on that relationship relative to the nominal yield. So if nominal yields move up less than real yields, then that would compress the break-even rates. If real yields move up less than nominal yields, then that could push up break-even rates. But for now, I mean, as long as the Fed is involved, I just see that as a broken signal.
I agree with that.
Yeah. As far as past useful episodes, you know, looking through it, I was actually surprised. I thought we had something on the break-even rate, but hopefully people found that helpful, my ramblings there. But in terms of other episodes, back in November 5th of 2021, we had an episode talking about taper. That's when the chatter around the taper began, and we might have snuck in some thoughts around quantitative easing. I don't know why I have so much problems with that. So that's, you know, when we started getting hits around QT, we might have talked a little bit about there as well in that November 5th episode. July 16th of 2021, we talked about the shape of yield curves and how that might impact some of the ways that you think about the market. That's definitely relevant to the conversation that we're having today. And then finally, we talk about the differences between the real and the nominal yield. So I suspect we did talk about break-evens there. And that was on an episode that we recorded on April 16th of 2021. So for newer listeners that haven't caught those, you can go back to those episodes and catch up if you want. Or for those that you need a refresher, feel free to check those out as well. And hopefully they can add to some of your knowledge base here.
Yeah. And if you go to our website, you can actually skip all the chatter and just go straight to the topic, which is helpful. So you don't have to hear about what the weekly returns were for a year ago.
Yeah, our communications team and our Twitter team have been doing a great job in time stamping when the actual topic of the week or the question of the week, depending on if we're making up the topic or if we receive the question, where those begin. So please check that out. And I believe if you just type in doubleline.com Monday morning minutes, that should at least get you close to it. You might have to do a little bit more digging, but it'll get you close.
That's right. Let's move on to the things to keep an eye on next week, because it's a busy week. And on Tuesday, we get the S&P, as someone said, S&P swallowing the world, another index that S&P bought. So the S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller 20-City Home Price Index expected to be up 18.6% year over year. Again, as we talked about in the housing at the beginning of the in the macro section, let's keep an eye on this. Maybe not this month, since this tends to be used as like a 3-month average, I think, of home prices. But let's look forward over the next few months to see how this is moving. On Tuesday, we also get the JOLTS, the job openings. That number is expected to be relatively unchanged at, I have it written here, 1.1 million. I don't know if that number is exactly right or not. But remember, Jay Powell did talk about that there were 1.7 job openings per unemployed person. So it's 11 million. So he had that 1.7 openings per unemployed person. So let's keep an eye on that JOLTS number, since Powell seems to be paying attention to that also. Thursday, we get personal income and personal spending. Both of those are expected to be up 0.5%. Income was flat last month. Spending was up 2.1. So we're expecting a little bit of a bump in income and spending to fall slightly, but still or fall relative to last month. And then we also get the PCE core deflator. Year over year, that number was 5. It's expected to be 5.5, up from 5.2. But again, Powell did, and obviously these numbers are kind of, the monthly numbers are baked into the annual numbers. But he's looking at the monthly numbers because everyone knows that the base effect's going up. And so you want to kind of see the actual monthly numbers fall. So that's actually expected to happen this month, where it's expected to fall to 0.4% from 0.5. That's on a core basis. Certainly having some energy numbers in there, we would expect the headline numbers to be a little bit higher there. And then on Friday, we get the ISM, or ISM, as you like to call it, Sam, manufacturing data for March. That's expected to be 58.6, which is flat versus the last month, but it's still expected to be expansionary. And then it is Pizza Friday, so we do get the non-farm payrolls. That number is expected to be a positive 475,000. It was a strong 678,000 last month, so still expected to be a good number, but not as strong as last month. Unemployment is actually expected to drop back down to 3.7 from 3.8, and the underemployment was 7.2% last month. So two numbers to also keep an eye on. And then the labor force participation rate, that's expected to be up to 62.4 from 62.3 last month. So all in all, kind of reconfirming that the labor market, the job market is very strong, and as Powell said, can withstand some rate hikes. And so unless we get a little bit of wobbling in these numbers, I expect the market to continue to price in a 50 basis point hike here in May.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely seems like it could be the case here. And I kind of lost focus there after you started talking about Pizza Friday and started thinking about that.
I mean, those are I guess if there's one thing you do miss from the office, it is that Pizza Friday.
Yeah. So as people start to make their way back, I know we're looking to start the reopening fairly shortly here. So maybe that's one of those things where we could try to, at least for our team, when we're all in the office, maybe we can get some pizza and make it whatever day of the week that we happen to be in.
Yeah, we can have pizza Tuesday.
Yeah, or pizza Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
That's right.
Do it.
All right, well, that wraps it up for this week, Sam. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in.
Yeah, thanks, everyone, for listening to us out there. In case you forgot, this is Monday Morning Minutes, in case you forgot where you were. But please don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. We're available to my knowledge, all the podcast platforms. But if for some reason you're not finding it there, just let us know via the email at minutes@doubleline.com. Or you can hit us up on Twitter at DLineMinutes. You can also hit us up with any questions that like John did, and we'll try to address them in our upcoming episodes, or you can drop us a comment or suggestions as well.
And thanks to John, we do know that email still works. So
yeah,
hit us up. You can find more information about Double Line and our podcast at the website, doubleline.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/doubleline capital. You can see Jeff Sherman, and they brought this up a bunch of times. They're preparing to nibble at risk in the latest episode of Channel 11 News with Ken Shinoda. Always have those two going back and forth on the macro and markets is an entertaining time, entertaining and informative. And don't forget to check out the most recent episode of The Sherman Show there on the YouTube. You can follow Sam and Jeff Sherman on Twitter at Sherman Show Pod. Hope everyone has a great week.
Thanks, everyone, and good luck out there.
This audio presentation represents DoubleLine's intellectual property. No portion of this presentation may be published, reproduced, transmitted, or rebroadcast in any media in any form without the express written permission of DoubleLine. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. To receive permission from DoubleLine, please contact media@doubleline.com. Neither DoubleLine nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast. Liability, including in respect of direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage, is expressly disclaimed. DoubleLine is not providing any financial, economic, legal, accounting, or tax advice in this podcast. The receipt of this podcast by the listener is not to be taken as constituting the giving of investment advice by any DoubleLine entity or individual to that listener, nor to constitute such person or a client of any DoubleLine entity. The portfolio risk management process includes an effort to monitor and manage risk, but does not imply low risk. Securities mentioned are not a recommendation or solicitation to buy or sell. These securities were chosen based on their active overweights within the representative portfolio to explain portfolio positioning and the forward-looking view of the market that drives such positioning. For the preceding year, beginning August 24th, 2021, a list of all positions is available by request at media@doubleline.com. Equities may decline in value due to both real and perceived general market, economic, and industry conditions.